Fast forward to the end of 2024. Think of your goals. What can you do right now to give yourself the best chance of succeeding? If you want to learn a new language, you absolutely should get Babbel. Be a better you in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. I absolutely love Babbel because their courses help me learn real-life conversational skills. It's so easy to learn how to order food, ask for directions, speak to the locals without having to consult language apps. Babbel has over 16 million subscriptions sold. Plus, all of Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are backed by their 20-day money-back guarantee. Here's a special limited-time offer for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, at babbel.com/SPP. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/SPP. That's spelled BABBEL.com/SPP. Rules and restrictions may apply.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
The podcast where we talk to smart people, but not necessarily done by smart people.
That is an awesome question.
This one goes down probably on one of my top five.
Hey, I like nutrition. I like to eat food.
This is the coolest thing ever. We're going to do this forever.
I wish I paid more attention in that class.
You know, I'm going to be honest. I don't understand that. As a man, I don't get it.
Welcome to SmartPeoplePodcast.com.
Hello and welcome to Smart People Podcast, conversations that satisfy your curious mind. Chris Stemp here. Thanks for tuning in. I got to tell you, this podcast is a labor of love because right now my newborn is screaming in the other room. My other kids are running up and down the hallway because, you know, it's nighttime and that's what they like to do right before bed. And all I need is like 3 minutes of peace and quiet to record this intro. And we'll see how it goes. Anyways, this week on the show, we're talking about the pandemic. You know, that thing that disrupted all of our lives for years, that all of a sudden seemingly is in the rearview mirror. The question is, what did we learn from it? Or even better, what will we do differently going forward? That was a question I had on my mind. So I reached out to authors of the new book called The Big Fail: What the Pandemic Revealed About Who America Protects and Who It Leaves Behind. In this episode, we are talking with Joe Nocera. And Joe is a columnist for the Free Press. His journalism has appeared in all types of publications, Esquire, Bloomberg, New York Times. He's written for and produced some top podcasts. And he wrote a book about a decade ago called All the Devils Are Here, which was about the financial crisis. So Joe has spent pretty much since 2020 until now, trying to understand the pandemic, its impacts, what we did right, what we did wrong. And he has a history as a journalist of looking at big global events and trying to evaluate what caused them, what happened, and how can we be better. Also, for those in the States, you might be listening to this on your way to a family Thanksgiving. And what we would say is, if you are, when you're sitting around that table, enjoying your mashed potatoes and gravy and turkey and all that good stuff, you should say to your family, you know what I'm thankful for? This amazing podcast called Smart People Podcast. And you should tell them all about it. And we should see a huge spike as soon as the holidays are over. That would be an amazing holiday present. Please share the love. Let's get into it. My conversation with Joe Nocera as we talk about his brand new book, The Big Fail: What the Pandemic Revealed About Who America Protects and Who It Leaves Behind. Enjoy. I I got your book here, The Big Fail. And I got to start off right out of the gate because I like to come out hot. Fauci, friend or foe?
Neither.
Yeah.
My basic view on Fauci is he was an absolutist when he should have been humble about what we could and what we could not do and what we knew and what we did not know about the virus.
What I can't understand is why do we always make that same mistake with people in power? Why do our politicians, why do our scientists, why do the people who are supposed to have our best interests at heart, why do they have the inability to explain nuance and show a lack of absolutism?
It's a good question. I think in Fauci's case, it's because he'd been doing this for so long. You know, he'd been a hero during first he'd been the villain, and then he was a hero during the AIDS crisis. And then he'd been through swine flu, Zika, Ebola, H1N1. He'd been through them all. Yeah. So, you know, this was a different kind of virus that affected people in a different way. And I think that he thought that his read on what should and should not be done was the right one, and that he'd been doing this for so long, he knew best. And in fact, we as a country would have been far better off if he had said, for instance, when he said, you don't have to wear masks very early on, if he'd said, look, we don't really know yet if masks are going to help or not. But right now, we don't have enough of them, so we got to preserve the ones we have for our healthcare workers. And then let's see as we proceed, you know, and then there's all kinds of things like that along the way. And that, you know, it caused people eventually to stop trusting the government. And I think I'm not blaming this solely on Fauci, but to be sure. But I think it wound up harming our ability to mitigate the pandemic because people just started at a certain point, they started to let the public health advice go in one ear and out the other.
I actually wrote down a quote from the book. You say, if we use the term pandemic, people are going to freak out. Somebody's a high-ranking official. And I feel like that's one of the frustrations with people is that the government's place to determine, you know, how we will behave if they give us honest information.
Yeah. And I think that, along with that is the fact that they didn't really take human behavior into account until it was too late. In other words, what were these mitigation measures? What was a lockdown? What was masks? What was social distancing? What was shutting down sports arena? How is it going to cause people to react and to behave? And they didn't think a lot about that. And so, you know, what happens let's get into 2021 or so, and you know, people start stop wearing masks on the subway, and then they don't get sick. And so they start to think, ugh, what do these guys know? They're not telling me. You know, my experience as a human is different from what the CDC is telling me I need to do to stay alive. So why should I listen to anything they say?
And then the negative implication of that being, again, applying the same logic to everything, and therefore the problem we get into when trying to understand something that we didn't understand.
Right. And still don't understand in many ways. I mean, we don't, why did it come in waves? Why was one part of the country hit and not another part? And then it would switch around. Why did all of that happen? We don't know. To this day, we don't know.
Well, and that actually brings me to a question I had. You've mentioned it a couple times thus far. You start the book talking about masks. Can you answer the question even today, if they're helpful?
I kind of can, actually.
Okay.
I was talking to Michael Osterholm about this. He's a very prominent University of Minnesota epidemiologist who was quoted a lot during the pandemic. And he basically said, you know, if you have an N95 and you wear it properly, you're being protected. But, you know, if you have a surgical mask and you go into a restaurant and you take the mask off to eat and then you put the mask back on, How have you been protected? So the real answer is that anyone can protect themselves on an individual level with a mask, if they have the right mask and if they wear it properly. But 95% of the population is never going to do that. They're going to wear the mask under their nose, you know, they're going to take it off sometimes, or they're going to wear a cloth mask that doesn't do any good. So on a society-wide basis, you definitely can say masks don't work. On an individual basis, you can say if you do it right, they do work. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it does. So to zoom out a little bit, there's a couple of places I want to start. I know that you and your co-author also wrote a book back in 2010, All the Devils Are Here, about the financial crisis.
Right, and her name is Bethany McLean. Let's not forget that. She's an amazing journalist.
Great, and you and Bethany, I know, work well together, and that's why you picked up this book together. My question is, to tackle the financial crisis of 2010 and then the pandemic a decade later, how frustrated do you get at our inability to learn from historical issues? Or do you think that we actually are good at reflecting on these big events?
Well, we're terrible about reflecting on COVID, and we'll get to that in a minute. Bethany makes a powerful case in the book. She's really the Fed expert and the Wall Street expert of the two of us, that in their efforts to mitigate the financial crisis, the Fed, that's when the Fed began this process of getting interest rates down to zero, long-term bond buying program that really had never been meant to be long-term. It was supposed to be a short-term fix during the crisis, and then it never stopped. And you know, Bethany's view is that, you know, this was a wild overreaction that it harmed us because it wound up giving us inflation, and it also caused a lot of deal making, private equity in particular, that wouldn't have happened because interest rates were so low. So so the frustration was seeing them do something that helped in 2008, 2009, and then kind of failing to stop it when it was no longer necessary. The financial crisis also, though, did lead to a lot of legislation aimed at taming the banks. And as Bethany points out in the book, that was a good thing. But what it did was it caused so much of high-level banking and trading and so on to be pushed to what she calls the shadow banking system, the hedge funds and so on that are unregulated. And so that really had a negative effect on the society because, you know, the government doesn't really have much control over them or know what they're doing. And they have had several crises, including one leading up to the leading up to COVID. So that is frustrating. And this one, the one thing they did after the financial crisis that made a lot of sense was they had a commission to try and figure out what went wrong. And for the most part, it worked very well. And we've had that historically in this country. We had it when the Challenger exploded. We had it actually after the crash of 19... when was it? Why am I blanking on this? The crash of 2029 that led to the Depression. We have historically had commissions that tried to figure out what went wrong and try to figure out how to avoid it happening again. In this case, we haven't had that. And we're probably not going to have it because the country is so polarized over these issues. Mm-hmm. If you put 5 Republicans and 5 Democrats on a commission, the Democrats will all say lockdown saved lives, and the Republicans will all say lockdowns hurt the economy and didn't save any lives. And so what have you discovered?
This episode is brought to you by Factor. Eating better is easy with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. You'll have over 35 different options to choose from every week, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Also, there are more than 60 add-ons to help you stay fueled up and feeling good all day long. What are you waiting for? Get started today and get after your goals. Fuel up fast with Factor's restaurant-quality meals that are ready to heat and eat whenever you are. Discover a wide variety of easy options for the entire day, like breakfast, midday bites, and more. Get as much or as little as you need by choosing your meals every week. Plus, you can pause or reschedule your deliveries anytime. We've done the math. Factor is less expensive than takeout, and every meal is dietitian approved to be nutritious and delicious. Factor is the perfect solution if you're looking for fast, premium options with no cooking required. Head over to factormeals.com/smart50 and use the code SMART50 to get 50% off. That's code SMART50, SMART50, at factormeals.com/smart50 to get 50% off.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Do you think that if you were to put these 10 politicians in a room, 5 Democrats, 5 Republicans, they would actually believe that line and how black and white it is? Or do you think it's just too difficult today to have nuance and to explain things in a moderate way as a politician?
I think it is too difficult to have nuance. But I also think it is true. I don't think these guys are faking it. I think it's true belief.
Really?
I mean, Gavin Newsom signed a law in California to punish doctors who spread misinformation. Well, what is misinformation? What is it? Well, I mean, he would characterize it as anything that strayed from the, you know, public health establishment line. But the public health establishment line hasn't always been right.
Right. I was just about to say, pandemic proved that, right?
But that's true belief. And then the flip side is, you know, the right really has come to the view that masks were a waste of time, lockdowns were a waste of time, social distancing was a waste of time. And then eventually, not everybody on the right thinks this, but, you know, a lot of them eventually came to the view that vaccines were more harmful than good, which is insane.
That's a bold statement. You genuinely think, from your perspective, many of them think that the vaccines are not just a waste of time, but a net negative?
Oh, absolutely. They talk about remember when that football player for the Bills collapsed? Remember that?
Yes,
I
do.
He basically had a heart attack on the field.
Yep.
So nobody knew then whether he had been vaccinated or not.
Right.
And yet immediately from the right, they said, oh, this is because he was vaccinated. He's having a heart attack because he has myocarditis or whatever you call
right.
it. Bad on that kind of name. Well, they had no idea. They had absolutely no idea. So, yes, there's no question that there's a very a Robert F. Kennedy Jr. type view.
Wow.
That vaccines are harmful and that they're especially harmful to children. Now, my view is that they're not. I mean, yes, they are. There are some people who have side effects, but that's been true of vaccines forever. All kinds of vaccines, polio, smallpox, whatever. My view, though, is that children don't need the vaccine because so few children get COVID.
Right. You know, the book is called The Big Fail. And I think that's an interesting one because obviously it insinuates that we failed. Why was it such a failure? I know there's many reasons, but what is the biggest reason in your mind that we can say, look, we didn't do well?
The biggest reason really has nothing to do with how we dealt with the pandemic in the here and now. The biggest reason has to do with trends that had taken place in American capitalism over the previous 30 or 40 years that we don't even think about anymore, that wound up having disastrous effects on hospitals, nursing homes, and shortages of supplies like nitrile gloves and and masks. And so let me drill down a little on this. Okay, so where, in percentage terms, more people died in nursing homes than any place else. And if you, the Times stopped doing this, but the New York Times for a long time was calculating the percentage of deaths per state that took place in nursing homes. And some of them were astounding. There was like New Hampshire's like 65%. I mean, astounding numbers. Wow. And even in the low, you know, it'd be like as low as 30 or 25%. It'd be as high as 70%. It was just amazing numbers. And why did this happen? The answer is, the main answer is because nursing homes had been stripped to the bone by private equity firms and other entrepreneurs. And they had debt that they really couldn't afford. So, you know, they have to lay off nurses and staff and patients and residents don't get quality of care, and et cetera, et cetera. And this is completely preventable. And the reason we know this is because in San Francisco, the largest nursing home in the country, 700 some odd residents, is run by the city, not by a private equity firm. Hmm. And they had plenty of staff, and they did it right, and they sheltered their people in place. And as of March 2023, 10 people had died in that nursing home.
Wow.
So it tells you that if you do it right, if you could do it right, you can save lives. But we had this situation, this setup where nursing homes were like, you know, they were out of a Dickens novel. So that's one example. The second example is, you know, globalization, which nobody really gave much thought to. But, you know, globalization became this nirvana for companies that caused them to shut factories, lay off workers, move everything to China, set up just-in-time supply chains. But they never thought about what happens if there's an emergency. What happens if there's a crisis? So now we're hit with a crisis. The Chinese may have contracts to send masks to America, but they're not going to do that in a crisis. They're going to keep it for themselves. Right. So all of a sudden, every hospital is scrambling for masks, scrambling for nitrile gloves. Mm-hmm. They don't have any, there's no resilience in the system. So that's a second way that, a big way. And then a third way is the way the hospital system has evolved, where the big fancy hospital chains, you know, they do fine, but they don't have the population that's really sick with COVID. And those people go to these hospitals that are, you know, kind of a mess, that they do the best they can, but they don't have the facilities, they don't have the equipment, they don't have the machinery, they don't have the money. They're dependent on Medicaid, which doesn't pay anywhere near enough. So, you know, you have some hospitals that are just completely overloaded and people are dying left and right, and you have other hospitals that, you know, I'm not saying they're empty, but they're not overflowing with COVID patients.
Those are three great examples, and I'm glad you brought those up. I want to dig into some because, you know, anybody who listens with regularity knows that I have left-leaning, but I'm definitely not a zealot or anything like that. And oftentimes, let's take the nursing home example. I get stuck in the middle because if it's not for capitalism, we don't get some of the innovation. I live near Washington, D.C. The government is highly wasteful and inefficient. So privatizing something versus making it public, I don't know. But in this instance, it worked. What made the difference there in the San Francisco one?
They paid their staff enough so they didn't have a huge turnover, you know. Okay. They were able to lock people down. They were able to take care of the patients. Mm-hmm. Wow. So the staff could be tested to see if they had COVID. They don't have COVID. They come in. They test. They test all the patients. You know, they're not. One thing that happened as people would die in the other nursing homes, they would need to fill a bed to make money.
Oh.
You know, and so somebody else would come in, new. They'd get sick or they'd spread it or whatever. And so in San Francisco, that didn't happen. It had a very stable population as well. So you're right about the government being inefficient. And and the way I think about it is that in the case of nursing homes and hospitals, if you're going to have a private system, a capitalist system, you got to set the right rules.
Right.
You got to have rules about how many, the number of staff. You got to have rules about what percentage of the revenue can be debt. I mean, what really offends me is the way private equity firms raped and pillaged nursing homes for their own benefit, put it in their pocket, and then they walk away.
Yeah.
You know, and did they step up during the pandemic? A few of them did, but most of them didn't. And honestly, I came to the view by the end of the book that there should not, that private equity should not be allowed into the healthcare system. They have no purpose. That, you know, hospital, most industries, profitability and doesn't clash with the purpose of the company.
Yes.
Right? With hospitals and nursing homes and healthcare in general, it definitely clashes. You know, if a hospital wants to have a more profitable quarter, they got to do more surgeries because that's the way the system works. Maybe those surgeries are necessary. Maybe they're not. Mm. Or you got to have a monopoly in one area so you can hold up the insurance companies to force them to pay more than they should. You know, or in the case of private equity, you know, you sell the land. I mean, the first thing they often do is they sell the land to a REIT, a real estate investment trust, and then pull that money out as profit. And now the private equity firm has to pay, now the nursing home has to pay rent on land that they used to own, right? And then in addition, don't forget, the way private equity works is they buy something. This is any kind of company. And they mostly use debt because that's how they make money. And they put the debt on the balance sheet of the company that they bought. So the nursing home company now has to not only pay rent, but they have to pay back the debt that the private equity firm used to buy it in the first place.
Well, that's crazy.
That's how it works. That's how it works.
And when I was reading your book and I'm going through and you talk about the healthcare system, because it's not just nursing homes, but hospitals, as you mentioned, I just had a virtual appointment with a doctor and she said, why didn't you go to your primary care physician for this? And I said, because I called him. They said it would take 3 weeks, which is absurd. And she goes, 3 weeks is nothing. I hear from people that can't get in for 3 months. And she explained to me, due to the pandemic, and this is why I'm telling this story, I'd love your perspective on it, that highly due to the pandemic, they also knew there was going to be a physician shortage prior to the pandemic. It's at a breaking point.
Right. The nursing shortage is even worse, actually. One thing that happened in the pandemic is that nurses just got ground down. They just, and you know, this is the thing that's killed them. You know, you're in a pandemic, right? So suddenly you can't do those extra surgeries, right? Mm. You can't make that extra money.
Right.
So what's their response? They start laying off nurses in the middle of a pandemic.
Wow.
That happened all over the country. All over the country. And it's just, you know, it's another one of those things. You know, they care about their bottom line. And patient care is secondary. They will never admit that, but it's true. And so, this gets to the big picture of why we failed was because we had a we had a healthcare system that was not set up to succeed in an emergency.
If you look at that, do you see any, I mean, do you see not just an end in sight, but this is going to happen again in some context? Will we take any of these lessons forward?
I don't know. I think that in the case of globalization, things are actually changing, because it turns out in the end, it wasn't just PPE and nitrile gloves that was short, but eventually we had a shortage of semiconductors. We had all kinds of shortages. I mean, really serious shortages of what's the drug? Adderall. We can't get any Adderall. There's a huge Adderall shortage in America. You know, there's just all kinds of things like that. And what you are seeing is a lot of talk, at least, about pulling back a little bit on globalization so that we make more things at home. That's certainly something the Biden administration is pushing for. But the flip side of that, it means that things will cost a little more. Now,
right.
Countries like Germany's a really good example. They accept that price. And in return, their workers have a lot more say than our workers do in how companies are run. They usually have the head of the union, their unions are on the board of the companies and so on. So they have a different, they have a different system. Would the hospital system change? No, but the private, nursing home system might change. The other thing though, the next pandemic might not hit the elderly. It might hit children.
Right. Exactly.
You just don't know. And, I mean, in this pandemic, it took a while for people to figure out that children were relatively safe from the pandemic. Even when they got it, most of the time it was asymptomatic. So, the influenza pandemic of the 1918, it killed kids, it killed middle-class people, it killed elderly people, middle-aged people, elderly people. It was indiscriminate. This pandemic was a lot more discriminating. The older you got, the more likely you were to go to the hospital or to die. Mm-hmm. The younger you were, the less likely, which gets into all these issues about how the public health establishment explained all this to the public and the ramifications of that.
Well, and there's a couple of areas you highlight specifically, and we've talked about some. Another one you focus on is the education system and the impact it had on that. Tell us what you learned there.
Well, let me preface this by saying that when the pandemic first hit New York in mid-March 2020, nobody really knew for sure how bad it would be for kids or anybody. So it made sense, really, to shut everything, to shut the schools down for a while, just get this all sorted out. But by the summer of 2020, it was pretty clear, it had become pretty clear that the children were largely unaffected. And that, I mean, it was geometric. I mean, the chances of an elderly person dying of COVID was like 1,000 times more than a 5-year-old. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people started calling for schools to be reopened. Some people. This was, you know, resisted mightily by the teachers' union. And in the big cities like New York, Chicago, L.A., you know, they didn't open for a very long time. And this was incredibly damaging to disadvantaged kids who lived in public school. Who went to public school. They not only missed out on learning, but, you know, there were free meals that schools hand out. There were, you know, social aspects of school that are important. For people, kids who lived in dangerous neighborhoods, schools were a safe place to be. You know, they had a lot of the failure to reopen schools was tragic. There are still like 300,000 kids nationwide who basically dropped out of school during COVID and have never rejoined the school system.
Wow.
That's a lot of kids.
Mm-hmm.
And for this, I believe at least part of the blame belongs to the public health establishment. You know, this is where you were talking about nuance and the lack of nuance. You know, this is where they should have been telegraphing loud and clear the distinction between an elderly person and a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old or a 10-year-old. And they should have been showing, illustrating to parents what the risks were versus what the upside was of going to school. And, you know, my ultimate view is that of all the things that went wrong during COVID, the closings of schools and the inability to reopen many of them for such a long time was just the single most tragic aspect of the whole thing.
Yeah, and I think what you mentioned up front is important because I remember I've got young kids, and I had young kids, obviously, during the pandemic. And I remember thinking, I'm not sending them to school initially. I remember being absolutely terrified of the pandemic for them. But to your point, once we got that data, so it would have been the fall of 2020.
Probably a little earlier than that, probably more like August or so.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, late summer, exactly when the school year was starting, we put my son into a private school that was in person, and he went all year. And I think this highlights two things, and I want to ask you. My wife is also a teacher, and so she went from the public school system to the private school system during this time. And how could we have dealt with this with teachers who were scared to go into work? If they had issues,
did she go in? Did she go into? Did she teach in a private school system?
She did in person.
Okay, so I had a very similar situation. I had a fourth grader in public school in New York City, and it was a shit show. March, April, May, June, and I can't blame the teacher. She had two little kids herself. She was trying to take care
of
them. She couldn't. Exactly. She didn't have time to teach us.
Nope.
Teach them. So I put them in private school. All the teachers went every day. They all wore masks. They all had proper ventilation. They had cohorts, you know, so no one in the sixth grade had any dealings with anybody in the seventh grade or the fifth grade. They were just, they were one cohort with their teachers were a cohort. And they did have some COVID, but very nothing to be worried about. You know, look, I think, I don't think you should have forced teachers to come back, but I think you could have, for instance, in the private school system, I don't know if this happened with your kids, but it happened with mine. There were some kids whose parents didn't want them to go back in the classroom. So fine, they had Zoom.
They did.
They were part of the classroom. They were with all the other kids. It wasn't like what had happened in March and April. It's almost like they're sitting in the classroom. The teacher could call on them just like she could call on anybody with a computer or anybody else sitting in the room. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. You could have done that with teachers. You could have allowed teachers to, you could have had a TV screen and the teacher could teach from there. And you could have had a young teacher's aide who could be in the classroom and help out. I mean, there are ways to do this if you think about it.
Yeah.
Instead of just saying, well, we have the system that we have and the teachers are scared and the parents are scared and the kids are scared. So no, we can't let them go back to school.
It's a good point. And I think it highlights a lot about the lack of flexibility that happens there. And like you said, the impact that the schooling had, it also highlights, you talk about who we protect and who we leave behind.
Right.
You and I both just said we put our kids in private
school. That's right.
Now, I couldn't afford it. My wife's parents had to pay for it, but we still had the means.
You mean this podcast doesn't make enough to pay for kids to be in private school?
Yeah, man. If it did, it'd be a different world, right?
Right.
But in truth, what did you learn about who we protect? And is it conscious that do we do this on purpose and just not and lie about it behind the scenes?
You say, is it conscious? You know, a lot of it is not conscious, honestly. Think about yourself or people in your social class locking down. How are you able to do that? You've got Zoom, right? So you can do work. You got your computer. You can have Zoom drinks with your friends.
Yep.
Oh, by the way, where are you going to get those drinks? Mm-hmm. Somebody from DoorDash is going to bring them to you, right? And and suppose you want to get, I don't know, get some new clothes. So Amazon workers in the warehouse. And if you want a nice steak tonight, who's making those? Meatpackers, where there was tons of COVID in the meatpacking industry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I hate to be cruel about this, but, you know, the Zoom class felt so virtuous, locking down.
Good point.
And so contemptuous of people in Florida and other red states that poo-pooed lockdowns and closing their economy, shutting their economy. And they just felt, and yet what they didn't seem to notice, that's the right word, was that other people were not able to do what they were able to do and had to go to work to service them.
Right.
And so, you know, how is that fit? So when you talk about who did it leave behind? Well, yeah, it left behind people who didn't have a lot of money. That's who it left behind. Mm. It left behind a lot of small business people who went out of business, small restaurateurs, you know, a lot of people who got laid off. But, you know, I will say the government did a pretty good job there of bolstering unemployment insurance. And, I mean, people seem to have enough money to buy GameStop and AMC. So they could have been too broke.
It's true. No, it's true. And, you know, it's funny. I just got an email a couple weeks ago from somebody providing feedback saying that, Chris, you talk negatively about capitalism too often. So I guess if they're listening, sorry, it's happening again. But I heard you, I think it was in an interview, talk about, for example, the airline industry. And I thought it was fascinating. Yet another example of maybe with the best intent, our policies really supporting the wrong people in that we gave them all this money and what did they do with it? Tell us a little bit about that. Any other examples you have about the, you know, our inability to do it correctly?
Here's another thing that has become an ordinary part of American capitalism that didn't used to exist before. Giving money, buying back stock buybacks, right? So, you know, all these airlines and tons of other companies have spent billions and billions of dollars buying back their own stock. So then the pandemic comes. Now, they're not broke. They have money, for sure. But they also have lobbyists. And Congress certainly doesn't want an airline to, you know, run into financial trouble. So they're going to give the airlines tons of money. But they say to the airlines, you have to employ people. If we're going to give you this money, you have to employ people. So they put the people on the payroll. I don't know that there's that much for them to do, but they're on the payroll. The day those deals expire, they lay everybody off. You know, and I don't know if the airlines did this, but there were a lot of companies that continued to do stock buybacks even during the pandemic. And they all sort of said, well, you know, our employees come first. We're going to take care of our employees, yada, yada, yada. But they didn't. They're incapable. The thought pattern of a corporate executive is now so ingrained with maximizing shareholder value and, you know, doing everything they can to boost the stock at the expense of just about anything else. Do you remember when, this is not a pandemic related, but do you remember when American Airlines gave all their employees a dollar an hour raise and Wall Street and all the Wall Street analysts went nuts? You know, how could you do this? You're going to destroy your shares. You know, the worst part of it, I am a capitalist. I've been covering business for 40 plus years. You know, it's in my blood. I like businessmen. I don't think it's all a big conspiracy like a lot of lefties do.
Sure.
But man, it's just it's hard to watch.
don't you think it can just be done slightly differently? I don't see why certain things aren't easy to fix.
Well,
I don't get it.
They are easy to fix, but you almost inevitably need Congress to pass a law. Mm. And our congressional system is so up that, yeah, you know, they're so dependent on corporate money that corporations really have the ability to squash almost anything. Look how long various Congress people have been trying to get rid of, you know, where they pay less taxes, because everything's considered a capital gain. People have been trying to get rid of this forever, so that if you're in Wall Street, if you're in private equity, if you're in a hedge fund, you pay the same tax rate as everybody else. They've never been able to get it to pass.
It's crazy.
And you know, they just have this, you know, corporate money just speaks too loudly.
Yeah, it does. Well, listen, Joe, I know we don't have much time left, and one of the reasons I want to have you on is it's kind of crazy how far in the rear view, in my mind, the pandemic is already.
Yeah.
How fast it came up. I still remember getting my first vaccination, and I teared up because I remember thinking, I think I get some of my life back. Like, I remember eating Thanksgiving dinner outside in the freezing cold with my parents because we had little kids and my parents are older and things like that. It just was such an important time in history, and yet I feel like it's now gone. And so I wanted to see, what do you want the general person to take away from the pandemic and the work you did on it?
Well, before we go to that, I want to just make a comment on what you just said. Of course, it's not gone.
But, of course.
But it's been normalized.
There you go.
Now, is that bad or is it good? That's a hard thing to answer. Ultimately, humans normalize everything. You know, London was normalized during the Blitz, eventually, right? People just got used to it. I mean, just that's what we do as people. So I think that if there were another pandemic, I think we would treat it very differently. I think unless it was killing like 20% of the population, I think we would deal with it in a less panicky way. Now, whether that's good or bad, I tend to think it's good, but that's me. Your question, however, was,
what would you want people to take away, given that for many it's in the rearview mirror and we have accepted it and integrated it?
Well, I think the main thing that I would want people to take away is how sad it is that we were so polarized that we could never discuss what worked and what didn't. We could never listen to each other about, you know, did the vaccines work? You know, what was the rate of problems? You know, have respect for each other's decisions instead of, you know, seeing people on the beach in Jacksonville and saying, you know, hashtag Florida morons. You know, the people in Florida and other red states feeling equally contemptuous of people in the blue states, saying, why are they locking down? Why do they have a mask? They're such idiots.
Yeah.
That, you know, I realize that this is true of our politics and other parts of our society, but working on this book and even living through COVID, this is what really hit me, is like, you know, I wrote we had an excerpt of the book in New York Magazine, and it got a fair amount of attention, especially on Twitter. And I got some comments that said, doesn't it bother you that all the people who were praising your article are right wingers? And I said, you know, I'm not writing this for a left wing or right wing. I'm writing what I think is true and factual. Right. And we shouldn't be putting this in buckets. Bethany was on Twitter fairly early on during the pandemic saying things that were clearly skeptical of the conventional wisdom. Mm-hmm. And people would come up to her and say, I didn't know you were a Trumper.
Wow.
And she said, what makes you think I'm a Trumper? I said, because you're skeptical of lockdowns. No, no, no. You should be able to have these discussions without it being part of our polarized culture.
Between, say, a Florida and a California, I think represent opposite approaches to the pandemic. Could you say history will define a winner? Was there a winner? Was there a better way to approach it?
Well, if you adjust for age, which you have to do, because Florida had 21% of Florida's population is over 65, and only 15% of California is over 65. If you adjust for that, they came up pretty much the same.
Wow.
California slightly better. California slightly better, but Florida made trade-offs that they were happy with. In other words, the Florida...
That's what I was going to say. The Florida, economically.
Right. The Florida economy was much better. And I know a lot of people from New York who went to Florida during the pandemic because they wanted that openness.
So it's possible to say if they have equal outcomes in terms of, you know, mortality rates and Florida's economy was better, then maybe we are saying Florida made the better decisions.
Maybe we are, you know.
Maybe we are. Well, to learn more, you're going to have to read the book. It's called The Big Fail, What the Pandemic Revealed About Who America Protects and Who It Leaves Behind. Joe, really appreciate you being on the show. Anywhere else, where can we find you? Are you active on social?
I am. I'm on Twitter. I'm on my whatever you call it, handle. What do you call it?
Yeah, handle sounds good.
Opinion_Joe. Opinion Joe. Okay. And I've been writing these days for Barry Weiss's Free Press. I don't know if you know what that is, but
I don't.
It's a fantastic new outlet started by a woman, Barry Weiss, who left the Times because she thought it was too woke and has created a very interesting journalism organization for people who don't accept the verities of the right or the left.
And are you doing a good job at it?
Oh, they're doing a great job. I'm not full time there. They're rocking it.
Fantastic. Well, I'm going to have to look into it then, because that's what we try to do here as well. I know you got to run, Joe. Really appreciate it.
I appreciate Thanks you having time. Me. I really do. It was a really fun discussion. Thank you very much.
Awesome.
A thank you to this week's guest, Joe Nocera. The episode was hosted, as always, by Chris Stemp and produced by yours truly, John Rojas. Joe's book, The Big Fail, What the Pandemic Revealed About Who America Protects and Who It Leaves Behind, is available wherever books are sold. We'll leave you with the quick housekeeping items. If you'd ever like to reach out to the show, you can email us at smartpeoplepodcast@gmail.com or message us on Twitter @smartpeoplepod. And of course, if you want to stay up to date with all things Smart People Podcast, head over to the website smartpeoplepodcast.com and sign up for the newsletter. All right, that's it for us this week. Make sure you stay tuned because we've got a lot of great interviews coming up, and we'll see you all next episode.